From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, why dads are excellent. We get a head start on Father's Day. Journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about growing up with his father, a former Black Panther who raised 7 children with 4 mothers. Comic Carol Leifer tells some of the risque jokes she learned from her father. Jimmy Dale Gilmore sings a couple of country music songs he was introduced to by his father. Alt-country and bluegrass musician Daryl Scott and his father Wayne will perform a couple of songs together. And saxophonist Branford Marsalis talks about growing up in a musical dynasty. His dad is Ellis Marsalis, the great jazz pianist and teacher. Our tribute to fathers coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Father's Day is on Sunday, but why wait? Today, we're playing excerpts from some of Terry's interviews that had sons or daughters talking about their dads. We'll start with journalist and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. One of the things that made Coates different from a lot of other kids in West Baltimore, where he grew up, was that his father was a former Black Panther. His dad ran a small Afrocentric publishing company called Black Classic Press. That was in the basement of the house. Upstairs, he presided over a family of seven kids. Coates writes about his childhood in his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. Coates is now a contributing editor and blogger for The Atlantic magazine. His article about Michelle Obama was published in The Atlantic in January, which is when Ta-Nehisi Coates spoke with Terry Gross.
You came from a very unusual home. Your father raised seven children with four mothers, and they were all, including the four women, considered your family. Would you describe the arrangement?
Yeah. The first thing to understand is it wasn't planned. That's the biggest thing. It's not like, and it certainly was a situation in which it was a polygamous household. My dad was a young man, being a young man, not necessarily always being particularly careful. I'm quite thankful for that now. He had relationships with four different women at various points. And in each of those cases, there were kids yielded. In two of the cases, it was multiple kids. With my mother, there were two kids. The first woman he was married to, the first wife, there were three kids. My dad hated the term stepbrother. He hated the term stepmother, stepfather, all that. We really didn't do that. He hated the term half brother. There were no halves. We were raised to be really, really close. And basically, most of the kids lived with their mothers for the most part. If a kid was having trouble in school, particularly the boys were going through a hard time. My dad has five boys. They would come and live with my dad. And my dad was, as many dads are across the country, the disciplinarian who would get the kid back on track. They would, you know, come over on weekends, so there might be different combinations of kids. It might be my sister Kelly and, you know, my sister Chris and me, or it might be my brother Big Bill, as he was called at that time, my brother Malik, my brother John and me. It could be any combination of kids. It was a very interesting thing. I have to tell you, though, I didn't consider it particularly unusual because, quite frankly, there were a lot of kids in the neighborhood who had a similar situation, except in most cases, the father was not there. And so I actually didn't necessarily feel I was blessed, but I knew I was blessed.
Did your father live in your home?
Yes, he did. Yes. Lived with my father all my life, until I was 18 at least.
Your father had been a Black Panther. Was monogamy one of the institutions he was opposed to?
Yes, it was. Very much so. And the Panthers had a sort of doctrine of free love at that point, which I write about in the book. I don't know how much my dad was in his mind opposed to monogamy when he hooked up with my mother. You know, child rearing was very important in my parents' relationship. And I think it overshadowed romantic love. It was about getting those kids together and getting them out the house and making sure everybody became productive members of society. And romantic love was really, really secondary, despite the fact that both of them had the yearnings that all human beings have. I don't know how much it was that my dad theoretically didn't believe in monogamy at that point in time, or that it just wasn't where he was from a romantic perspective, that he really wasn't in love for most of the marriage.
Your father published, had a small publishing company in the basement, published books by African-American authors, Afrocentric books. Did you read those books growing up? Did they have an influence on you?
I devoured them. I devoured all of them. and, you know, felt a way that I felt at the time and later, you know, come back and question some of the stuff. At the same time, seeing the importance of having it out there. At the time that I was coming up in Baltimore, crack had hit the city and guns had just flooded everywhere. I mean, I'm talking about 10, 11, 12-year-old kids with guns. Out on the corner selling crack. It changed the temperature. It changed the volume. It changed how the city felt. It was a much more violent city during the time that I was coming up. And the thing you have to know about me is there was no religion in our household. So there was no broader sense of what should explain where we are. And I think just as a kid searching for answers, I was looking for anything to explain what was going on, why young boys were being shot over starter jackets with the Philadelphia 76ers written across the front, why, you know, a kid would come to school in a pair of shoes and end up walking home in his socks because he got beat up and somebody took off his Air Jordans. I didn't understand how it was that my world was like that, and yet you would cut on the TV and there was a completely different world, obviously, out there where people had nice lawns and, you know, kids just went to school. They didn't necessarily have to worry about any level of violence. I took to, quote-unquote, Afrocentric books as a way to explain that to myself. It was a kind of a mythology, a religion for me that explained where I was, who I was, and how I had ended up in that particular space.
At the same time, you also read a lot of comic books. You say, my default position was sprawled across the bed, staring at the ceiling or cataloging an extensive collection of X-Factor comic books.
Yes.
So how did your father react to you reading comics in addition to you reading serious books, you know, what he would consider serious books?
My dad had a position that kids reading was a good thing, and you had to take kids where they were. You mm-hmm. really, really did. I also write in a book about how I played Dungeons and Dragons. Now, you have to, you know, knowing my dad and where he was in terms of Black consciousness, having a kid, you know, play a game that is based in, you know, Tolkien and Norse mythology sounds like a weird mix. But in fact, my dad appreciated the imagination that was inherent in the game. He appreciated the sort of abstract level of reasoning. That there were a number of things that young Black kids were doing at that particular point in time that was not particularly healthy, and yet here I was with my brother doing this, exploring a creativity. My dad was very, very encouraging of that. Now, we would have a lot of conversations about race and how race played out in those particular worlds, but he never was, you know, a sort of person that was like, I don't want you playing the white man's games or something like that. I don't want you reading the white man's games. That didn't really exist in my household. He was always very encouraging. And the other thing that you have to understand about my dad is when he was a kid, he collected comic books.
Uh-huh, okay.
So that was key. That was key. And so there was, in fact, a moment when I was young that he talks about when my mom, you know, tried to get me off of comic books and get me into more serious reading. He said, you know, don't do that. Don't do that. You know, the boys read. Encourage that.
You said that your father would tell you when you're on your bed reading that you had to go outside, that you had
yes.
to, he said, this is your community. These are your people.
Right.
What did that mean to you as what I imagine was a kind of alienated teenager or preteen mm-hmm. reading X-Men comics at home?
I was very angry at him. I was very, very angry that he was sending me out. I, again, and this is, you know, just to put this chronologically, this is at a period before I start reading, you know, books about African Americans for myself as opposed to being assigned. I didn't understand why my world was different. And moreover, I felt like I had two parents, two really smart parents. I had a mother who worked as a teacher. I had a dad who worked at Howard University. Why were we living in West Baltimore? I didn't understand that at all. I felt like if we could, you know, we were as good as anybody else. We could live in the suburbs, have nice lawns, et cetera. This is my thinking around 12 or so. Moreover, why do I have to go out and be around kids who are of a different background than me? Now, here's the lesson that my
kids
dad
who wanted to beat you up, too, I might add.
Yes, yes, yes. Some of them. Some of them. I developed some great friendships. But yes, that was certainly part of it. Now, my dad's thing was that he was raising men as it came to me for all seasons. He wanted people who were comfortable in the neighborhood, people who were exposed to things outside the neighborhood, people who could be comfortable in many different worlds. You know, he had a great, great feeling that despite what was going on in the community, you could not, and I can remember my mother, in fact, saying this all the time, you could not be scared of your own people. You could not. Now, you had to be smart. You had to be safe. You had to take certain steps, but you could not develop broad, big sort of paintbrush ideas about Black people.
Did your parents live in West Baltimore, which was largely a pretty poor community, would you say? And you said the crack epidemic had really spread there. Did they live there for political reasons as opposed to economic reasons?
Yeah, I think as a child, I interpreted it as political reasons. I think it was partially political reasons, but it was, in fact, at the end of the day, also economic reasons. I mean, we owned our own house. It was a good house. My dad still owns it to this day, and it wasn't particularly expensive for the time. And I should, just to be very clear about where I was, you know, West Baltimore, like any sort of broad area that gets painted as a ghetto, was actually quite economically diverse. So the area where we were was pretty much a working class area. I would not call it necessarily a poor area. We had Section 8 housing and that sort of thing. But it wasn't like I was raised in the projects or something like that. It wasn't that sort of situation. Now, you can't insulate yourself from what's going on in the broader community of West Baltimore and the city as a whole. But where I was raised, there were not a lot of fathers around, but the mothers who were there worked, and they worked hard.
We talked a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in and the impact that had on you. You're raising a son now. What kind of neighborhood are you raising him in? And did you consciously choose that neighborhood to raise a son in, or did you just end up living there and having a son?
Right. I live in Harlem. I'm in Harlem, which, again, I mean, it's tough to, people think of Harlem as a ghetto. It's very tough to describe Harlem as a ghetto because it's just so diverse. I mean, there are folks like me who are college graduates there. There are people who have been there all their lives. I'm, you know, just the other day I was doing some reporting and I was riding around with a gentleman who lives in actually the projects of East Harlem, who was working on getting his son into an elite boarding school up in New England. And we drove up there and did that tour. There are all kinds of people there. I'm a big fan of the diversity within the Black community and sort of bringing that out and myself, you know, exploring that as a writer. I do want Samari, my son, to have some sort of consciousness about what it means to be an African-American. Now, that'll change by the time he's, you know, of an adult, and he'll have to figure some of that out for himself. But I don't want him in a situation, as I think sometimes happens with certain people, in which he perceives African-Americans as alien to him. I don't want him learning about African-Americans from watching TV. I don't even necessarily want him learning about African-Americans strictly from listening to music. I want it to be a lived experience. I think Barack Obama said something really great in the campaign. I think about this always in regards to my son. He said, I'm rooted in the Black community. I'm not limited by it. And that, if I could do anything for the kid, I mean, that would really be what it was.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tara.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, is out in paperback. Coming up, comedian Carol Leifer on memories of her father. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our next guest on this special Father's Day salute is comic actress and writer Carol Leifer, who got an early start in comedy hearing her father tell jokes when she was a kid. She started working the comedy clubs when Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, and Larry David were getting started, and they became her friends. She later wrote for the NBC series Seinfeld and has starred in her own TV comedy specials. Terry Gross spoke to Carol Leifer earlier this year upon the publication of her memoir called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win.
Carol Leifer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Your opening essay in the new book is about your father, who recently died at the age of 86. And you write that he's the reason you wanted to be funny, because he was funny. And in this piece, you tell one of the jokes that he used to tell. It's a, quote, dirty joke that you didn't get when you were a kid. It is such a great joke, so I have to start by asking you to tell it.
Okay. Well, a guy goes to the movies with his pet chicken. And he buys two tickets, and the person says, who's going in with you? And he goes, well, my pet chicken here. And the ticket person says, hey, you can't bring an animal in the movie theater. So the guy goes around the corner, he stuffs the chicken down his pants, goes into the movies, and the movie starts, but the chicken is starting to get a little hot. So the guy unzips his fly to let the chicken stick his head out and get a little air. So a little bit of time has passed by, and a woman nudges her friend and says, you know, this guy next to me just unzipped his pants. And the woman goes, ah, look, you know, you've seen one, you've seen them all. And the woman goes, yeah, I know, but this one's eating my popcorn.
I love that.
Yes, hilarity ensues. But I remember as a kid, you know, my father telling this joke a lot and getting big laughs. And I was young enough that I didn't really understand it, you know, because all I heard was a chicken and, a zipper. And it didn't really make sense. I found out, you know, what the joke meant later. And that just might have been the thing that pushed me into lesbianism, but
which we'll get to later.
Yeah, but I really, you know, my father was the king of the joke tellers, and I was so impressed as a child watching him hold people in rapt attention with these stories, and it had a big impact on me.
So, did he actually collect jokes?
He did. My father, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he'd always say, throw at any subject and I got a joke on it. And he really, one of the high points of his life was my mom is a PhD in psychology, and she went to one of her psychology conventions, and the scheduled entertainment for that night had canceled. And the psychologist, knowing that my father was a big joke teller, asked if he would mind stepping in and telling some jokes. And as I hear it, you know, he was thrilled and delighted. And he, I think, told about a half an hour or 45 minutes of jokes, and he killed. And it was really a fantastic night for him. I think to my father's generation, to have a career in show business was not something that was accessible or something that someone actually did, you know. And I'm really happy that he lived long enough to see a lot of my success and was so happy for me. So it's, you know, it's nice that he left this earth, you know, having seen that and shared that with me.
When your father died, the family found a list of jokes that he kept in his wallet. Did you know that he had that?
I did know that he had that list of jokes. We all did, my brother, sister, and I, because, you know, it ties back to that evening that he entertained the shrinks at their convention. I know that he thought if they ever asked him to perform again, he wanted to be prepared. So he had his list of jokes there.
So when the family was dividing up his possessions, you got the paper with the jokes that you say you now keep in your wallet.
Yes, I do keep it in my wallet. And if I'm ever stuck at a show, I'm certain I will have no problem whipping it out and going through the list. I did a special many years ago. I think we spoke about it the last time I was on the show, called Gaudy Body and Blue, which was a tribute to these bawdy, dirty comedians of the 50s and 60s. And I had asked my father to put on tape every dirty joke he knew. And I think it's about 2 hours worth of jokes. And I'm so happy that I kept it, so that I really feel like I have my father's legacy with me, because he wasn't a pro, but he had excellent timing. He was an amazing comedian, and people who knew him, the first thing they always said about him was that he was so funny. And I talk about that in a piece, that I think if my father knew that being funny was the first thing that people said about him, that would be enough and make him happy, not having had a professional career.
Well, what he did for a living, he was an optometrist.
Yes, he was. He was. But, you know, he always shared funny stories about, you know, being an optometrist. You know, people would come in and he'd ask them, you know, can you please read the eye chart? And they would ask out loud, no, sir. You know, why don't you mime it for us? Of course, out loud. Or he would have people that would read the eye chart and go, capital E, capital F, capital, you know, it's like they're all capitals, okay? So, I miss him so much.
Now, you pointed out that your father and his friends never thought that a show business profession was anything that was in reach, but obviously you did, and you did it. So what made you think when you were young that it was within reach for you, that you could go, you know, be a professional comic?
I think because I started so young, it was a dream that seemed possible to pursue. You know, I started doing stand-up comedy as a junior in college. You know, my mother had said, I thought it was something that you'd get out of your system, you know. But I clearly remember my father saying, you know, Dad, I passed the audition at this comedy club and I want to transfer to Queens and try to become a comedian. My father's like, you know what? You got to strike while the iron's hot. And I think that was great advice. I think it was an opportunity not to be missed. But I do think the fact that I had still finished my college degree, that was important to my parents. And I think to my generation of comics, it was within reach. I think to certainly to my dad's generation, I remember asking him why he had never pursued it. And he said, well, you know, someone's got to make a living. You know, that generation, that it was a really far off dream and not within the realm of possibility.
Carol Leifer speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. Her memoir is called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win. Here's a great song Loudon Wade Wright III wrote for his daughter. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
That's my daughter in the water. Everything she owns, I bought her. Everything she owns. That's my daughter in the water. Everything she knows, I taught her. Everything she knows. I say she takes to heart. Everything she takes apart. That's my daughter in the water. Every time she fell, I caught her. Every time she fell. And that's my daughter in the water. Every time I fought her, yeah, I lost every time.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Masterpiece Mystery with six new Agatha Christie mysteries. Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple are back, starting Sunday on PBS. From Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Fathers and Sons. Jimmy Dale Gilmore sings his dad's favorite songs. Wayne Scott and son Daryl tell the story of dad's debut album at age 71. And saxophonist Branford Marsalis talks about growing up in a musical family. His dad is the piano player Ellis Marsalis. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. For the second half of our Father's Day show, we've got three musical sons telling stories about their respective dads. First up, Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Gilmore is a singer from West Texas who writes songs that would be described as alternative country. But in 2005, 5 years after his father died of ALS, Gilmore recorded an album of classic country songs called Come On Back. It was dedicated to his late father and featured songs his father loved, including one by Jimmy Rogers, for whom Jimmy Dale Gilmore was named. Gilmore visited Terry in the Fresh Air studios in 2005. he brought his guitar, and also brought guitarist Robbie Gerso, who accompanies him on the Come On Back CD.
Welcome, everyone, to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you here. Jimmy Dale Gilmore, this new CD is dedicated to your father, who died a few years ago. I want you to start with a song, Pick Me Up On Your Way Down. And what did this song mean to your dad?
Well, actually, it represents an entire style that I really associate with him. It's this old, it's honky-tonk dance music is what it amounts to. And it is one particular one that he really loved. I have this memory of him just, with his kind of head tossed back and with his eyes closed, just grinning when this kind of music was on.
Would you play it for us?
Yeah.
One, two. You were mine for just a while, now you're putting on the style, and you never once look back at your home across the track. You're the gossip of the town, but my heart can still be found where you tossed it on the ground. Pick me up on your way down. Pick me up on your way down. When you're blue and all alone, when their glamour starts to bore you, come on back where you belong. You may be their pride and joy, but they'll find another toy, and they'll take away your crown. Pick me up on your way down.
That's the way we fake being the band playing the song.
And that's Jimmy Dale Gilmore on guitar and singing Robbie Gerso, who's singing harmonies and playing guitar. And that song is from Jimmy Dale Gilmore's new CD, Come On Back. That sounded really great. As we mentioned before, the CD is dedicated to your father, who died of Lou Gehrig's disease. Did he introduce you to country music?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He was from my very... very earliest memories, that music was always pervasive. You know, it was radio. We didn't have a phonograph until I was actually in high school.
Wow, that's pretty late.
And but my dad, we always had the radio going, you know, and my dad played. So he would be sitting around the house playing his guitar along with the radio, or actually, you know, sometimes playing that with the bands for dances.
And you quote a great advertisement for a dance that he was playing, where he apparently he was one of the first musicians in West Texas to use a solid body electric guitar.
That's right.
So would you describe that ad?
Yeah, it said at this time when I was very small, we lived in Tulia, Texas, from the time till I was about 5 years old, and on a dairy farm, and my mom recently, you know, a few years ago, found a little clipping from the Tulia Herald, little tiny ad that said dance at the VFW hall featuring with the Swingaroos featuring Brian Gilmore and his electric guitar.
That's great. The Swingaroos.
Such a novelty.
So did your father teach you guitar, or did you learn that on your own?
He taught me just a little bit. He taught me how to play Wildwood Flower, and the thing is that I fell in love with the acoustic guitar, and my dad was an electric player. Mm-hmm. And I never did. To my regret now, I never did really learn to play the electric well. I can fumble through with it. But I just learned. My dad taught me a tiny amount, and then I kind of went off into really more in the folk and blues direction as I was learning to play.
I want you to do another song from your new CD, Come On Back. And the song I'm going to ask you to play is a Johnny Cash song called Train of Love. But tell us first how you first heard Johnny Cash and what he meant to you.
Well, I may have heard a few of his recordings on the radio a little bit. This was when I was very young. But my first real memory of it was my dad took my sister and I to see Johnny Cash with Elvis Presley. And I was about 12. I think she was about 10. And it was, I've often said that I suspect that night completely determined the rest of my. I think that was one of those places where a little deflection happened. That I loved that music so much. I loved both of them.
Boy, I wish I was at that concert. It must have been really early in their career, right after they both signed with Sun Records. At that concert with Presley and Cash. Wow. Well, would you do that song for us, Train of Love?
Yeah, I will.
Train of love's a-coming, big black wheels a-humming, sweethearts waiting at the station, happy hearts a-drumming. Oh, train men, tell me maybe, ain't you got my baby? Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home. Train of love's a-leaving, leaving my heart. But early and late I sit and wait, because I'm still believing. Oh, we'll walk away together, though I might wait forever. Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home. Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home. Ever so often everybody's baby gets the urge to roam, but everybody's baby but mine's coming home.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore, visiting Terry Gross in the Fresh Air Studios in 2005. The CD dedicated to his father is called Come On Back. In a moment, we'll come on back with another country music father-son story about Daryl and Wayne Scott. This is Fresh Air. Here's another musical father-son story for Father's Day. Daryl Scott is an alternative country singer-songwriter who won an ASCAP Songwriter of the Year award in 2002 and plays with Steve Earle's Bluegrass Dukes. Daryl's father, Wayne, is in his 70s and installs chain-link fences. When Daryl Scott became successful enough with his country music career to start his own record label, the first thing he did was pay tribute to his father. He produced an album of Wayne Scott singing mostly his own songs, the songs that Daryl heard his father sing when he was growing up. The album is called This Weary Way. Terry spoke with Daryl Scott and his father, Wayne Scott, in 2006.
Daryl Scott, Wayne Scott, welcome both of you to Fresh Air. A pleasure to have you here. Daryl, when you started your record company, the first album you released was by your father. Now, you know, you're pretty well known in the world of country music. So why did you want your first record to be your father's music?
Well, I just thought it was important. His music is important. I know I'm his son and all that, and there's that going for it, but I really feel that his music is important just because it's so pure and true, especially to the form of really country music or mountain kind of music. I heard these songs all my life, and I know them backwards and forwards, and it was just time to finally get him to come and record these, you know, with a bunch of my friends down here in Nashville, or in some cases we went to him up in Kentucky in his living room, and I just thought it was time.
You've said that you used to think that all the songs he sang were by Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and other venerated songwriters. When did you realize a lot of those songs were his own?
Well, yeah, they kind of blended together because around the house he would do all of that. He'd do Johnny Cash and Hank and Merle Haggard and all that and his own. And there was a time where I didn't know which was which. It was just all blended in as what I thought were great songs. I'd say probably somewhere in my mid to late teens I started catching on that, okay, that's the Hank stuff and there's the Johnny Cash stuff and really starting to see his songs, which were his. And actually it took, there was one song, which is the title of the record, This Weary Way. I didn't know that that was not a Hank Williams song until my late 20s. It just seemed so perfectly Hank in terms of style, in terms of structure, and that may be, from my opinion, my dad's best song. And so that's one that took me an extra 10 years to figure out that it wasn't Hank's.
Wayne Scott, why didn't you make it more clear to your sons that you were writing songs?
I decided to try to be a singer instead of a writer. I tried singing my songs once, and I didn't like the cold feet and cold shoulder I got singing them.
And he's talking about a club. I mean, we used to play clubs like when I was a teenager. So he's talking about a night playing in a bar, you know, where they come to dance and drink and play five sets a night as far as the band is concerned. So that's what he's referring to, you know, that he did his songs one night, and, you know, of course they wouldn't know the songs and wondering why he's not doing, you know, the top 10 of the country music at that time. So I think that was his brush with trying out new, you know, his material out in public.
Did you give up after one shot at it?
Yeah. I've never done it again. Now that's all I do, and it's great. I'm glad that he talked me into doing it, and it's a new experience to me, and people actually listen to me, too.
Well, you very, very generously offered to perform a duet for us, so I'd like to ask you to do a song that Wayne Scott, you do on your CD, and it's called Sunday with My Son, and it's a song that you wrote. Let me ask you to tell us what you're talking about in the song. It seems to be a song that directly comes out of your life.
Every word of it's the truth. That's the only way I can write. I only have inspiration. I don't have no education. Not that it's a gripe. I chose it. But my son was the youngest one. I hadn't seen him in a long time, and I had him one Sunday afternoon for 3 hours, and I just love nature, so we went out into the woods to gather leaves and pine cones and things like that. And it was so beautiful, the song started going. I had to keep turning my back to him to not let him see the old man crying. And I come up with that song. So by the next morning, I had all of it, and it said exactly what I wanted it to say, and this is it.
So
you want to hear it now?
I absolutely want to hear it now, yeah.
Okay. 1, 2.
As I look back on some bitter years, some things don't mean a thing. Like chasing women, writing songs, riding trucks and old freight trains. When I reach back for happy thoughts of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most is a Sunday with my son. From the mouths of little children comes truth and honesty. And this I kept remembering as we gathered autumn leaves. When memory feeds upon the past of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most was a Sunday with my son. filled his heart with happiness the way that he fills mine. But you just can't make up 10 lost years in just 3 hours' time. Reflections calls for happy thoughts. When it does, well, I've got one. One thing that I remember most is a Sunday with my son. From the mouths of little children comes truth and honesty. And this I kept remembering as I gathered autumn leaves. When memory feeds upon the past of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most is a Sunday with my son. When memory feeds upon the past of things that I have done, one thing that I remember most is a Sunday with my son. Sunday with my son. Sunday with my son.
Oh, thank you for doing that. That's Wayne Scott singing and playing and guitar, and his son Daryl Scott accompanying him on banjo. And Daryl, thank you for bringing your father to our attention.
Absolutely,
by
truly
recording
my
him
pleasure.
And pushing him forward like that, like that.
So, truly my pleasure.
So Daryl, you have actually been able to make your career in music, both as a performer and as a songwriter. I mean, you as a songwriter, you've had several hits on the top of the Billboard Country chart.
Mm-hmm.
Did watching your father when you were growing up, watching him perform, but making a living all kinds of other ways, from working in the steel mill, I think, and
mm-hmm. steel mills and fence construction,
yeah,
delivering oil and mm-hmm. all sorts of things,
and moving mm-hmm. around the country. So uh-huh. watching him do that and just kind of playing on the side, did you think, well, me, I want to really play professionally and make my life playing?
Yeah, I think I kind of knew that even as a kid. It just was, I wouldn't say easy for me, but it came naturally. It was like a natural thing for me to gravitate toward and to play. Because I grew up in a family band. My dad, of course, played and sang and wrote, and I had older brothers who played and younger brothers. And, you know, it was just the kind of what you do as a family, how some go camping or fishing or into baseball or whatever. And our thing really was to play music. And so I was kind of, online for that, really from the age of 6, I started playing. And, because our family business was fence construction, which is a really hard labor out in the sun kind of thing. I also learned, you know, at about 11 or 12 that it was better for me to stay home. And while the others were working, someone needed to answer the phone and cook. We were a bunch of bachelors, basically. My brothers and I lived with my dad. And so I was the cook, and so I found a way to get out of hard labor actually pretty early. And I just kind of kept that up. I'm still not into hard labor.
Wayne Scott, when your sons were born, did you look at them one by one and think, this is going to be my band?
Yep. That's why they're...
Yeah, he absolutely did.
They're all D's.
Yeah, all your sons, their names all start with the letter D. Why is that?
Yeah, that was for that reason. And they're...
What, so you could start a band with them?
Yeah. And their introduction to music was when they come home, I laid them in the bed and stood over them and played Hank Williams, Johnny Cash. Played with them about an hour or so. So you wouldn't wake up when you heard me singing at 2 in the morning, you know, and for those reasons.
Yeah, we were used to it.
Oh, that's funny.
So they can sleep right through country music, or they can play it. Daryl, you knew he was a musician, I'd say at 3. And well, all the boys are professional, but... Daryl's the best. I mean, if it's got strings on it, he can play it. And At 3 years old, it was vivid that that he wouldn't be no fence builder.
So how did having sons whose names each started with the letter D help you in playing music or creating a band? I mean, I don't get that
part. I was going to name them the 2 D's, the 3 D's, the 4 D's, or however many D's it took. It's all going to be D's, you know.
So Wayne Scott and the 4 D's, the 5 D's, yeah.
That's the way it came. And honestly, that was the reason. I was determined they'd be musicians.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks,
Terry.
Wayne Scott and his son, Daryl Scott, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. The father's album, produced by his son, is called This Weary Way. Coming up, another musician, Branford Marsalis, talks about his father. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're concluding our Father's Day salute with jazz saxophonist Branford Marsalis, brother of Wynton and son of the great jazz pianist and teacher Ellis Marsalis. As a kid, Branford spent more time listening to Elton John and Led Zeppelin than he did checking out the music that his dad was into. But Branford now has a long string of jazz albums to his name, as well as some genre-busting efforts, including his group Buckshot LaFunk, which combines jazz and hip-hop. In the pop world, he's performed with Sting, The Dead, and Bruce Hornsby, and for a few years led Jay Leno's Tonight Show band. Terry spoke with Branford in 2002.
You grew up in what is now America's probably most famous jazz family, the Marsalis family. Your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist. When you were growing up liking the pop music that you liked, did you feel about his music the way, say, I felt about my father's old Benny Goodman records?
I felt about my father's music the way that my next-door neighbor felt about his father, the chauffeur driver. That was just what he did.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about your father's
Benny Goodman records? Oh, I really disliked them until I got much older. Well, in my 20s, anyways.
Jazz is not for kids. And I know there's an argument. My brother says jazz can be for kids. I don't think jazz has a level of sophistication that's just way too hip for kids. It's not a music for kids, and it certainly wasn't a music for me. But it wasn't like he'd play them and I'd go, arr! I would just leave the room.
He just didn't care.
And turn on the television in the other room until it was my turn to listen to my music. And then I'd put on Cheech and Chong and Elton John and, you know, James Brown and whatever I wanted to put on. And my father would stay out. And then when James Brown came on, he'd come in and say, yeah, kid, yeah, Jack, I like that. And then he would always dance to it. When he danced to it, he would snap his fingers on 2 and 4, which was the funniest thing in the world, you know?
That's great.
You know, yeah, cold sweats going on, you know? Mm-hmm. Like a cold sweat. Dun, dun, dun. Do, ba, da, do, do, dee, da. My father's going, yeah. Do, 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 dee, da. I'm like, no, Dad. It's just funny.
It's on the one.
Oh, yeah. It was classic.
That's great. So what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was the piano. And then when I was a freshman, when I was in the first grade or second grade, went and started playing the trumpet. And I wanted to play an instrument. So I said, I want to play the trumpet. And my father says, no, we're not going to have two people playing the same instrument in the same household. So you have to pick something else. I said, okay, clarinet. Okay, fine, you get the clarinet. And I played the clarinet for 7 years until I was a sophomore in high school, and then I switched to the alto saxophone because I wanted to be in a funk band.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are no clarinets in funk bands.
And if there were, it would be really bad. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't be a good vibe at all.
So tell me, has your father been really pleased over the years that you've come to love jazz and play it?
Now he does. But my whole career to him was just one, because my dad is, he has two words. I mean, he always said, I mean, like typical Ellis Marsalis fashion, he says, yeah, man, you know, you and Wynton are interesting, because see, Wynton's a concrete sequential, and you're a random abstract. I actually named a record Random Abstract, because he was saying, I said, what are you talking about, man? Just talk to me like I'm your son. What was this concrete sequential crap, you know? And he went through it, you know, went just things like A, B, C, D, E, F, and you're like A, F, B, Z. And he just didn't understand that, because if you have to really, he's a concrete sequential. So it just seemed like, it seemed just rampant, just like a pell-mell kind of thing. Like, what in the hell is he doing? I mean, I just confused the hell out of my poor dad.
Branford Marsalis, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002, he concludes our special Father's Day salute. So on behalf of fathers everywhere, and of daughters and sons who love them, happy Father's Day this weekend. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the estate of Richard Leroy Walters, whose life was enriched by NPR and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover public radio. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audio books, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, backstage at the Colbert Report with Alison Silverman, head writer and executive producer. She'll tell us whose bright idea it was to take the show on the road to the combat zone in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.